Now I say, how did he do it? After a while, this gets old. Blind man said, well, why are you asking me this?
You are students of epistemology, and you're always knowing about how do you know, and how can you be sure, and why, and how far. Why are you asking the question? If you really have the evidence and the understanding, will you then believe? Is this the reason you're asking me, or are you just badgering me? And they said, we are children of Moses. We're the sons of Moses, but as this man, no one knows where he came from. We don't believe he's of God. The blind man says, well, I don't know anything about epistemology. I don't know anything about philosophy or theology. But you're throwing up dust to blind your eyes and trying to blind mine. You're not going to blind me. I don't know all the answers to this. But I do know this, that no man since the world began who was born blind has ever seen. Can you name one case of a man born blind that saw? Psychological blindness? Oh, yes, that can be healed even today. Hysteria blindness? Yes, that can be healed today. But not born blind. That's a different thing. No, we never had. Well, let me ask you this. If a man was born blind and now he sees, quite obviously this could not be done by a charlatan. This could only be done by the power of God. And God gives his power only to those who are righteous and not false. Now, if the man were not of God, he couldn't have the power of God. And the fact that he had the power of God to heal my eyesight ought to be overwhelming conviction, my friend, that this man is none other than the promised Messiah, that he is of God. Now, whether he's a sinner, I don't know all these questions. But I do know this, and you can talk until you are blue in the face. I was a blind beggar, and this man has healed me, and I now see. And they said, you young upstart. We've got the PhDs around here, and you don't know nothing. You can't even read and write. You don't even know Braille. You've never read a book. You don't know anything. And you're coming to teach the chairman of the departments, are you? Well, you get out, friend, and never come back in here, and you're reviled, and you're never to come back in the synagogue or the temple again. So the blind man goes out. And then he's troubled. You can see him walking by himself. I was a blind man. And he healed me. Now instead of rejoicing that he had the power, they throw me out. Which is an indication of the rebellion of their own soul. They don't want to see. I was blind physically, but they're blind spiritually, these men. I wonder where Jesus is. I shall try to find him. I shall be grateful until I die. He healed me. And Jesus knows and seeks out the blind man. Coming to the simple blind man, he says, did they cast you out? Yes, they cast me out, sir. But you stood for me, didn't you? Yes, I did, sir. I can't answer all their questions. I don't know how mud could hear me. I don't know why I had to go to the long road pool of Siloam. But I do know this, sir, that if you were not a man of God, you couldn't have done it. Dost thou believe on the Son of God? And notice his answer. Well, Lord, if you tell me, I'll ruminate on it. I'll meditate on it. I'll cogitate on it. I'd like to believe it, I just can't believe. Yeah, just can't do it. I'm sincere, I'm so sincere. But it doesn't add up. Doesn't figure yet. Let me take and speculate on it for a while. Let me philosophize about it for several hours and days. Give me a little more evidence. Give me a little more time. That's not what he said. He said, dost thou believe on the Son of God? And what did he say? Who is he, Lord, that I may believe on him? And Jesus said, he it is that speaketh with thee. Thou hast seen him. I am he. Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. What do you have? A man who believed in Jesus Christ. A man who lived in front of his ignorance and his doubts. A man
who was willing to do what the Lord said in spite of all of his misgivings. A man who experienced the truth, who hungered to know more, and held what he knew with unshakable convictions. This is genuine faith. There are those today who tell us there's no evidence for Christianity at all. It's purely a matter of faith. There are those who say, if I don't have the evidence for everything, I will not believe. Here's the true experience. There is evidence, if you're willing to put it to the test. There is not the answer to everything. The Lord doesn't promise this. He will give you an experience. He will give you evidence, which is sufficient to convince any hungry soul who will put it to the test. But no amount of evidence will convince a man who's rebellious. And when the Pharisees and the Sadducees saw a man born blind, now seeing, when they had all the evidence of the marvelous power of God, and the only conclusion they could come to is the blind man with his simple knowledge, but absolute rigid logic could say, if he were not from God, he could do nothing, they said no. And then Jesus said something that's very significant. What does he say? I have come into the world that they who are blind might see, and those that see might remain blind. This is the irony of the sharpness of his discernment. And Jesus said, for judgment I came into the world, that they that see not may see, and that they that see may become blind. And those of the Pharisees who were with him and who heard these things said unto him, are we blind also? And he said, if you were blind, then you wouldn't be responsible for your sin. But you profess to see. You profess to be philosophers. You profess to be theologians. You profess to be learned people. You profess to know. And you will not come unto me that you may know. Your sin remains. This is true on a college campus. Dear students, if you wait till you can learn the answers to all the questions of life, you will be immobilized so long as you live. The things which you know in this world, either in the realms of science or in any other realms, is so small as to be one small fraction of a fraction of 1%. You know very little. Now, are you going to build your life in the areas of the things you do not know? Or are you going to build your life on the little pinpoint of experience which you do have? This is what the blind man did. There are lots of things he couldn't answer. How mud could heal your eyes? Why he had to go to the pool of Siloam? Why Jesus couldn't do it right now? Why he was blind from his birth and other people not? The problem of sin. He could have stayed right where he was, and he could have said, unless you can answer me these questions, unless you can tell me how mud can clear my eyes and convince me, unless you can tell me the medicinal qualities of earth mixed with spittle, unless you can explain to me why you did something as so unsanitary as to spit upon my eyes, unless you can tell me why I was born blind, unless you can tell me the answer to the problem of evil, unless you can tell me why I have to go to the long road to the pool of Siloam, unless you can tell me all the answers to these questions, I will not do a thing, and I will not believe him until he answered all my questions. He'd have been blind till he died, wouldn't he? What did he find? Jesus told him to do one thing, and this he was willing to do. Now, if this room represents the areas of truth that you could know, the little area that you are standing on would represent the area that you do know, and the rest of it you do not. Now, there are people in university campuses in all areas that are living out in this methodological, this skepticism all around them. They're always out in the vague areas of the things that you don't know. How do you know that prayer is real? How do you know that there's a God? How do you know that the Bible's true? How do you know that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? How do you know there's a heaven? How do you know there's a hell? How do you know what's right? How do you know what's wrong? How do you know this? How do you know that? How do you know this? How do you know that? Now, it's perfectly all right to have a certain method of methodological skepticism, lest we be duped by every charlatan that comes down the pike, but there's a place to remember that you'll never build your life on a question mark. You'll slide off and fall down. You've got to get down on something solid, if it's only as big around as a pyramid, and stand on that. Many people will not. Our pastor was speaking today, and he was relating a story which was told by Borum of a man in London, a man who was very modest in his learning and ignorant in many ways, who had come to know Jesus Christ, and in the zeal and exuberance of his faith, he was bearing his testimony, and he came in contact with an atheist, a free thinker, who began to catechize the man and say, you're ignorant, you don't know very much. That's right. When was Jesus Christ born? Well, he didn't know when Jesus Christ was born. And how old was he when he died? Well, I remember how old he was when he died. And how is it possible that miracles could break natural law? He didn't know all these things. And the atheist badgered him and badgered him. And he said, you see, you're just an ignorant fool. You're just a credulous dupe. And you believe all these things about a man. You don't know when he was born. You don't know how long he lived. You don't know anything about scientific reasoning. And you believe all this. Why do you believe? And the simple, ignorant man of the slum said, well, there's lots of things I don't know. But I do know that a short time ago I was a helpless drunkard. And I used to come home and my wife was cowed before me as I beat her and my children fled in terror when I came home. And I was ashamed. And then I found Jesus Christ. And he changed my life. And I'm no longer a drunkard. My family rejoices when I come home. My little children are no longer fleeing from me in terror, but they're glad to call me Father and rejoice in my presence. I do not know when Jesus lived. I do not know how old he was. I do not know when he was born. But I do know that he transformed my life, sir. And you can't take that away from me. Thank God. And he was willing to live on this. You see, a man with an argument is no match for a man with an experience, as old Ralph Byron says a good many times. He's not. They could fuss with the blind man as long as they wanted to. But the blind man's answer was, gentlemen, I don't know the answer to all the philosophical problems and speculations. I do know I was born blind. I know I've never seen. I know he told me to go and wash in the pool of Siloam. I went and washed, and now I see. Will you live in front of your ignorance or behind it? Will you live in your doubts and your fears? Or you live on the few things that you do know. As old Mark Twain used to say in his very humorous way. He said, you know, the passages in the Bible that I don't understand, they don't trouble me. And there's lots of them. He said, you know, it's the passages in the Word of God that I do understand. Those are the ones that give me trouble. I'm troubled with those. They do. Now, where will we live? In front of your doubts. Down at the University of Iowa. Iowa State University. I was speaking to a group of students. Youngish girl came up afterwards. She was a senior student, had majored in philosophy, and she began to ask some questions. She said, you know, sir, some things you said tonight or this afternoon, it was an afternoon meeting. We'd gone out in a little fellowship. We had gone out on out into the little retreat grounds up back of the place, a few rods or half mile or so. Had our morning session, and we'd had some hamburgers and hot dogs and mustard and catsup, you know, all kinds of things, any of that sort of business. If you haven't seen your grandmother for 40 years, you'd seen her before morning. If you went to bed right away. Then we'd had a session in the afternoon. Finally, we'd come in, you know. And she was asking afterwards, she said, you know, there's some of the things you said, Professor, that I don't understand. Well, I said, that's wonderful. I said, lots of things I said I don't understand either. She said, no, that's what I didn't mean that. Well, I said, you could have, because lots of things I say I don't understand at all. I think they're true, but I don't understand them. Well, she said, that's not what I meant, though. And I said, what was? She said, you talked about the virgin birth. I said, yeah. She said, I don't understand that. I said, neither do I. She said, you talked about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I don't see how a dead man can be risen from the dead. I said, I don't understand that either. She said, you talked about being born again by the Spirit of God. She said, I don't understand that. Well, I said, neither do I. She named a few. And I said, wait, do you mean to say that because you can't understand them, you thereby do not accept them as true? She said, that's exactly what I mean. I said, that doesn't follow, does it? Oh, she said, it does for me. You see, I'm a student of philosophy. And like old Descartes, unless it's perfectly discernible to my mind, I do not accept. I said, sweetheart, old Descartes or somebody sold you a bill of goods. She said, did they? I said, yes. I said, as a matter of fact, 99% of the things that you accept as true day after day after day, you do not understand them at all. Oh, she said, now, Professor, I am not a credulous fool. Well, I said, that's a mild understatement. If you actually believe this. Now, I said you didn't believe the virgin birth. She said, that's right. Unless I can understand how a person could be born of a virgin, she said, I won't believe it at all. I said, let me ask you this question. Do you understand a normal birth?
She said, well. Well, I said, let me add. I said, if you do, you're the only person in the world that does. Nobody understands a normal birth. I said, here are two microscopic germ cells that in the mystery of holy wedlock are united. And I said, in those two cells, you have the genes and the chromosomes and all the structure of your mind and body with all that's involved here. And within the genes and the chromosomes of these two cells, male and female, you have the color of your hair, the shape and the size of your face, your stature, whether or not you'll be 10 talented or 5, whether or not you'll have genius in the field of music or whatever it may be. You have all the marvels of mind, the development of an eye, all the facilities of this psychosomatic system, all this within these microscopic cells. They're united, and for 9 months you grow and develop in the dark recesses of your mother's womb. Now, from the moment of conception, your mother couldn't do anything to you but harm you. She couldn't help you. She can't give you 10 talents if she wants to. She couldn't make you skilled in mathematics, not as far as the skill goes, but the ability to be skilled in mathematics. She couldn't give you ability or aptitude in music. She could not change you from somebody who was homely to beautiful. She can't change anything for the good. She can harm you by not caring for herself. This she can do, but she can't help you at all. And after 9 months, you're born into the world with the marvels of a human body, with mind and heart and eye and hand. That's amazing, isn't it? Have you ever thought of the human eye? No instrument like it, is there? And with this eye, you see two dimensions. And you see, for example, things which are focused through the pupil, and you don't need a photoelectric cell to adjust to the light. This is automatic. And you have the color and the shade that no, for example, photographic instrument can touch, focusing on the rods and cones, the retina. The image is upside down, left, right, two dimensions. With this eye, you see another image from a slightly different perspective. In your mind, these two-dimensional images, which are upside down, left and right, are straightened around, right up, are blended into one instrument with three dimensions, and you don't see two people flat, you see one person with three dimensions. I said, how do you get that done? And I said, all this your mother did. I was speaking to the engineers and the engineers at the University of Toronto. They were about to graduate, this was several years ago, and I was jawing about their skill. I said, fellows, you're wonderful in your engineering. Now you're going out to be mechanical engineering, something and so on. I said, remember, with all your genius and with all your slide rules and with all of our modern gadgets, you are not in any ways at all the engineer that your mother was. They looked at me, I said, there's a lever, par excellence. I said, that's a lever. I said, with all your genius, you'll never make a lever like that. I said, no zerk fittings, you know, no pulleys to get off, but I said, here it goes, wherever you want it to go. That's what you call a lever, you see, with facility. Here it is, a hand. Have they ever developed one in the world today like this? No. That's a lever. I said, how did this all happen? Do you understand a normal birth? And she said, no, I don't. Well, I said, sweetheart, if you don't understand a normal birth, let me ask you this question. Do you believe you're alive? Yes, she said, I am. I said, that's what I thought. But you said you would not believe anything that you cannot understand. Now, you don't understand how you could be born, so consequently you are not born? Now, I said, sweet, if you don't understand a normal birth, what makes you think that you are so sharp that you will not accept the virgin birth of Jesus Christ when our Lord wanted to signalize the coming of his own Son into the world by the marvels of being born a virgin? You're not going to accept this because you cannot understand it, and yet you believe you're alive and you don't understand a normal human birth, and no one ever has understood a normal human birth. I said, do you understand how it is that food turns into thought? I said, how is it that these hot dogs we were eating and hamburgers with mustard and catsup, all of which has weight and color and aroma, you know, and taste and tang, and you eat the hamburger and the french fries and the go-go-la and all that's involved, you know, and tomorrow you have the power to think a philosophical thought. I said, how does a hamburger turn into a thought? And I said, here are these things that have weight and color and aroma, and they become a thought, which has neither weight nor color nor aroma. I said, oh, yes, some of them do have aroma. Excuse me, they do have that. How is it that this happens? She said, I don't know. I said, nobody else does, but I said, I know what you're reading. Read it. Does anybody understand what electricity is? No. Unless I can understand electricity, I won't turn on the radio. You take two copper wires, attach them up to some kind of electric circuit, and through these two copper wires, for years, there may pass an electric current. The copper wires, so far as we know, are not affected in any manner. and they won't wear out. And you can pass through those copper wires, barring the corrosion of something other than electricity. And through those copper wires, electric current will pass, and nothing will mar those wires by the electrical current under normal circumstances. Put them on this, becomes something that's cold. Put them on something else, something that's hot. Put them on something else, you have something that turns into light. Put them on something else, something that turns into sound. Put them on something else, you have something that turns into power. What is electricity? Nobody knows. Is it electrons bumping one another in some kind of a continuum? No. As a matter of fact, some of your brilliant electricians are not even convinced they know which way it goes. Does it flow from positive to negative or negative to positive? Well, the fellow who wires your house, he'll tell you it's very simple. Here was a student graduating electrical engineering from MIT. He said, gentlemen, he said, there's some puzzles here. In our mathematical computations, electricity has to go one way or it throws our mathematical computations into a cocked hat. But in some other things, like a Wilson cloud chamber and some places else where we experiment, it seems to be going the other way. Now, actually, we do not know which way it flows, actually. But you are now a skilled electrician. You don't even know what the stuff is and how it goes, but go out and be an electrical engineer. See? Fellow be right simple stupid. He said, if I can't understand electricity, I don't believe. You see how simple this becomes? Now, are you going to live in the 99% of the things that you don't understand, or are you going to live in the 1% that you do? Now, this becomes an attitude towards life. Where were you? Do you remember the classic In Doubt? This is Othello, Shakespeare. And Iago decides that he's going to infiltrate into the mind of Othello that his wife, Desdemona, is not true to him, and that she's having a relationship with Cassio, Iago's immediate superior, whose slot in the military totem pole he wants to take. And if he can only infiltrate into the mind of Othello, the captain, that Cassio is having an affair with his wife, then Cassio will be removed, and then Iago will be one notch up. So he begins to infiltrate doubt into the mind of Othello. A little here, a little here, a little here. Instead of Othello living on the places that he knew to be true, or going to the source of knowledge, even his wife, and asking her, or investigating it honestly, he feeds upon this doubt. He rolls it over and over and over and over in his mind, and then in the denouement of the drama, you remember how Othello goes into the bedchamber of his wife, and he throttles her to death. And Iago laughs with a mockery of hell. And that's what Satan will do with you. If he can get you to ask some question that you can't answer and no one else can. If he can get you to become so skeptical that you are sold a bill of goods by darkness, that because you cannot understand all the light, you won't enter in, then he can keep you living in the darkness where there's no light at all. And he'll steal your soul. The blind man wouldn't permit it. Now, he went to the religious teachers of his day, and this was tragic. Instead of them helping him to see the truth, they wanted to blind his eyes to it. But he said, no. Will you live in front of your doubts? In front of your ignorance? Now let me add this in passing, dear students. Jesus Christ never promised to give you all the answers. He never promised that. And you will not have all the answers in this life. He never promised. He said, I am the answer. You take my hand. And anything I want you to know, I'll tell you. And anything I don't want you to know, you trust me. And someday, when we pass into his presence, when no longer will we see through a glass darkly, then we shall understand as he understands. But until then, when he says, go to the pool of Siloam and wash, we wash. Then we understand. Now, Jesus, in the blind man hungered to know more. Do you? Now, many of the reasons why we don't learn about the truth of Jesus Christ is we don't hunger to know the truth. Do I really want to know? Do I? It happened to be after a military conference in Berchtesgaden in Germany this past June. A colonel was there. The Spirit of the Lord fell on the meeting. And after the meeting was over, he said to me, you know, sir, I'd like to talk to you someday about a Christian home. And books on family life and family devotions and the family altar. He said, would you be willing to sit down and talk to me about these things someday and show me some good books I could read? I said, surely. I said, we've got some books here in the hotel. And I said, I'd be glad to sit down. I said, how about tomorrow after lunch? And he sort of hemmed a little and Sharp came up and he said, Doc, he said, I think maybe he wants to talk to you now. Well, after the service, we had divided up into prayer groups and we were each one going to our prayer group. So I said, well, Colonel, do you think talking about books on how to have prayers at the table is more important than going to prayers right now? Well, he said, yes, I think it is. Really, don't you, Colonel? And the Colonel, whose name was Tom, his inferior didn't call him Tom, but his name was Tom, said, well, yes. I didn't understand it. I was a little dull of perception at the time. He didn't even know the Lord. This was his way of saying, how do I find Jesus Christ? And he started in by this back door method, you know, let's talk about the table grace, you see. When actually he was saying, how do I get saved? That's what he was saying, but he didn't know how to get that out. Or else he was a little timid about it and embarrassed, and how do you use this jargon? So we went and talked, still a little dull of perception, and I know better, but it was a conference for Christians, not for non-Christians, although they turn up, we know that too. And he talked about this. I asked him if he's a Christian. Oh, yes, he said he was a Christian. Well, I suppose he was, but he was not. Later, when I asked him if he knew Christ, he said, no, he didn't. And finally, as we went around, you know, and we were probing here to find what his difficulty was, he didn't know the Savior. Then we began to talk to him about Jesus Christ. Explained to them the simple method of salvation. And I said, let's pray, when he said this is what he wanted. So I prayed for him. And I said to him, Colonel, you pray. And he started out and uttered about one sentence. Dear Lord, he said, I want to make Dr. Bob's prayer my prayer. And he broke down and cried. And he wept. With sobs. I took out a clean handkerchief. I said, here, Colonel. I prayed for him again. I said, did you really make my prayer your prayer? He said, yes, I did. I said, you really want Jesus Christ as your Savior? He said, yes. And you're willing to make him the master of your life? He said, yes, sir. You're willing to make him the absolute Lord? He said, yes, I am, sir. And then with half in joy and half in tears, he wept some more. And I did. And then we went to see General Harrison and Granville Sharp and Ira Palm. Went to see his wife. I just heard from Buxton day before yesterday. He said, they say that man is devouring the Bible. He said that man is rejoicing in the Lord. He's hungry to go on. And he says, you know, I've lost so much time. And I've lived in the world so long. I just want to learn everything I can about Jesus Christ. Is he hungry to know? Will he grow? Oh, yes, he'll grow. He'll grow. He hungers to know. And this is the way he grows. If you don't want to know about Jesus Christ, he's not going to clobber you, dear people. The blind man, when Jesus says, dost thou believe in the Son of God? He could have said, I appreciate you healing my eyes, but this is a little too much for me. I can see now what I'm going to do. I'm going to get down and open myself up a booth at the state fair and have myself a time. Friend, I'm going to make money. I'm going to do everything. But as far as following the Son of God, that's a little too involved, you see. I'm willing for all these gifts, material things and physical things. But when it comes to the spiritual things, you see, I don't want to be known by my friends as a kind of a religious nut. You know, how far would he have gotten? That's as far as he'd have gotten. He would have never learned the experience of the grace of Jesus Christ and his saving mercy. He hungered to know more. Now, what's the last point? He held what he held with unshakable convictions. Do you? When you're in a fraternity house and they say, are you a follower of Jesus Christ? What do you say? When you've had an experience of the grace of God, as we say to young men in the military, now you've been converted, you've accepted the Lord, yes. Now you go back to the barracks, you go back to this, and they're going to ask you, where were you? Now are you going to tell them or aren't you? Are you going to say, well, I was off in a little kind of a place. Oh, we had a little rest out in the mountains. We had a wonderful time. The mountains were lovely. Scenery was beautiful. Snow capped. We saw this and this and this and this. You never get around to actually what happened. Is that the way you're going to do? Are you going to go back to the barracks? And when they say, where were you? What are you going to say? I was down at Berchtesgaden. We had a wonderful time together, some fine Christian men. And you know what, fellas? I accepted Jesus Christ down there. And the Lord forgave me. I'm saved. I won't tell you about it. Is that what you do? Are you willing what is experienced in the quiet recesses of your own soul to shout from the housetop? The blind man wasn't afraid. Not in a fraternity house where they can do very little.
or on a college campus where they can do very little. He was unafraid in the very centers of the religion and the culture of his life, because all of Judaism was woven around, for example, a religious point of view, as Japanese culture has been woven around Shinto, and American culture is woven around this or whatever it may be, and the Indian culture is woven around the Hindus. His culture was woven around the center of Judaism, and in the very center of the culture, he was unashamed of Jesus Christ.